The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Oh, what have you done, girl? And it was you. Don't you lie to me. Last man coming into the way told me a gemstone hit the Father Abbot, and that all the monks were amazed that someone had struck so hard and from so far away. They had wards in place against such attacks, so it said. So they and I know the assassin was a person of great power with the stones. Only one person I know could have done that.
Avalyn Desbrus could have torn his head from his shoulders.
And Avalyn is dead. We both know that. And we know, too, who it was that has his gemstones. And one of those stones was Lodestone, was it not? And it was a Lodestone that hit the Father Abbot. So where is your Lodestone, girl?
Kilsippany has suffered greatly at the hands of Father Abbot Mountwatch.
She acted rashly and without regard for greater events about her.
Events that she could not know of, since we have not contacted her.
Events that include the child in her womb? That fact alone should have stayed her hand. The Abelican Church will realize almost absolute control over the city now, and they will orchestrate every movement of King Danube, using security as an excuse. Your friend has cost us much.
Jill the Assassin.
You hit me hard, my dear. Do you see what you have done to me? And only by the power of the gemstones am I able to paint an image of my face as it was. And only by the telepathic power of the Soul Stone am I able to communicate so that those around me think that I am speaking to them. I know you, and I am coming for you.
Father Abbot, you must flee!
Hinder her not! And know that when this day is through, our power will be even greater in Hans the Bear. Begone!
Don't miss the cataclysmic conclusion of the third book of the Demon Wars saga, The Demon Apostle, Part 3.
In a land where no good deed goes unpunished, Frank Morgan, the last gunfighter, is in for a lot of punishment.
Come on, let's go see about this.
Bragan.
If that was one of your parts, I'm afraid they crossed the divide, fella. One shot up real bad in front of the cabin. The other still inside.
I'm called Roof. Roof Blake.
Anybody you'd like for me to write to?
You mean to tell him I'm dead?
Just in case.
My ma and sister who live in Flagstaff. Ma's name is Alma Blake. My sister is Tess. I got wages coming from the Lazy F spread owned by Howard Flynn.
I'll see to it that your ma and sister get what's coming to you, Roof. Don't you worry.
Hold your fire, mister. We just want to find out if our parts are all right.
Come ahead. But keep your hands where I can see them.
That looks like a couple of our friends.
One's Roof Blake, the other's called Bragan. That's all I know about him. Wardell's still in the cabin.
What happened here?
I rode up and found the cabin on fire, and those men lying out here. They'd been shot as they ran outside.
He's lying, Buxton. I'll bet a hat he's the one who killed them boys.
Morgan's in for punishment and a lot of headaches.
I don't normally wear a badge.
Yeah, before, though. So it ain't like I'm asking you to do something you've never done.
I'm on my way to Phoenix. I've been mixed up in enough shooting scrapes in my life.
I can see why you feel that way. But the plain fact of the matter is, we need you here, Frank.
Punishment, headaches, and Frank Morgan ends up with a target on his back.
Shit!
Morgan! It's Frank Morgan! He's their leader! Get him!
Frank Morgan?
That's my name. What business is it of yours, mister?
Just making a note of it. I like to keep track of these things.
What things?
Oh, just the men I've killed.
Saddle up for William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter number 14, The Devil's Legion, in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Sonny Lasky, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Tony Nam, Ken Jackson, Thomas Penny, Lily David, Richard Rowan, Stephen Carpenter, Tom Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael John Casey, and Nanette Savard. Survivalist number 18, The Struggle.
John Rourke stared through the plexiglass panel running along the bottom of the portside fuselage door of the Soviet gunship. There was nothing but snow, jagged peaks, and rocky ravines below. Pine trees stood in random patches, and riderless horses moved in bands over the landscape. In some instances, the horses dragged their dead Mongol riders by a stirrup over the merciless terrain. The animals left what trails there were and tacked at bizarre tangents over the ridgelines to escape the noise of the aircraft. Under a gray sky, swirled with more snow, the gunship carried John Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, Michael Rourke, Maria Leuden, Vasily Prokopyev, and a team of his KGB elite soldiers away from the second Chinese city's ruins. The plexiglass vibrated. The images below, even the dead men dragged behind their animals, shimmered. The Soviet gunship shuddered, and a black and yellow fireball swept aft from the helicopter's cockpit chin bubble. Vasily Prokopyev and Rourke's son Michael moved as a single being, hurtling their bodies away from the belching flames. John Rourke was already moving, tearing one of the armored fire extinguishers from its mounting beside the fuselage door. The younger man grabbed for the second extinguisher even as Rourke spoke. Rourke swung toward Michael and Prokopyev, spraying their backs with a white stream of foam. Prokopyev rolled across the fuselage deck. Michael whipped away one of the blankets covering the unconscious Chinese agent Han Lu Chen and smothered the flames racing over Prokopyev's tunic. Rourke shifted the extinguisher toward the cockpit, where Paul Rubinstein already advanced against the flames.
No good, John!
The gunship vibrated maddeningly around them as if it were going to shatter.
They are crashing!
John Rourke advanced against the flames, but Paul was right. No good. The extinguisher was dead in his hands, and he threw it down.
Get on!
My men! I must...
They're dead! Damn it, Vasily!
Rourke wheeled toward Han Lu Chen. He caught a glimpse of Michael shaking Prokopyev violently. In the next instant, the KGB Elite Corps commander was up from his knees.
Help me!
Rourke quickly unlatched the restraining buckles that bound Han Lu Chen into the webbing hammock. The Chinese, beaten senseless by the torture masters of the second city, lay comatose.
Maria, get to work! Paul, you and Michael, get the fuselage door open and stand back! Flame!
One of the safety strap buckles was stuck. Rourke grabbed the butt of the LS-10 at his side, raked the primary edge over the strap, severing the fabric. As he sheathed the knife with his right hand, he hauled up Han Lu Chen with his left. Rourke put his shoulder into him, then threw the Chinese intelligence agent across his back. There was a rush of frigid air as Michael slid open the door.
Look out!
A rush of fuel-scented flames filled the cabin on the heels of a cold blast.
There's another fire extinguisher forward!
Paul ran past Rourke toward the inferno that was the cockpit.
No!
Rourke's friend was gone, into the flames, then stumbling back, the third fire extinguisher tumbling from his fingers, rolling across the deck. Prokopyev was on him, flipping the extinguisher to Michael, then smothering the flames which assaulted Paul's legs and arms, beating them out. Maria Lloyden dropped to her knees beside Prokopyev, using her coat to fight the flames. Michael Rourke moved relentlessly forward. He attacked the fire along the port side of the aircraft at its very heart, the overhead control panel. The opening was clear.
Whatever we're doing, do it now!
John Rourke stood beside the fuselage opening, the ground coming up fast, the gunship mere yards above the snow. There was no other choice.
Everybody, now, follow me and jump, and God help us!
Rourke looked back once. Paul Rubinstein was scrabbling to his feet, Prokopyev and Maria Lloyden helping him. There was no time to judge, to wait for a better spot. John Rourke shifted Han Lu-Chen into his arms, shielding the unconscious man's head with his forearm, and then jumped. There was a rush of frigid air, Rourke's face and bare throat and hands pelted with shards of ice and blowing snow. Rourke slammed to the snow-packed ground, his left hand covering Han's face. Rourke and his unconscious comrade slammed hard to a stop. His left wrist throbbed with pain as he moved it. He looked up and back, brushing snow from his eyes with his right hand. He hoped the others had already jumped. The Soviet gunship skipped over a rise of ground.
Paul! Michael!
Rourke was to his knees, still cradling Han Lu-Chen in his arms. He stumbled forward, easing the Chinese into the snow, then got to his feet. When he moved his left wrist, it hurt, but nothing felt broken. He glanced at his Rolex. It was apparently unscathed. His whole left side, shoulder, rib cage, hip, and knee felt as if he'd been run over by something. He stumbled forward, automatically reaching under his open parka for a gun. They had been shot down.
Michael! Paul! Maria! Prokopyev!
Rourke turned so quickly his head began to swim. There were floaters in front of his eyes, his breathing still shallow, labored. Michael was standing in the snowfield 100 yards away, silhouetted by the still-burning gunship. Rourke started toward his son. Paul sustained no serious new burns, nor had Prokopyev or Michael. Maria Lloyden's hands were slightly burned, but again, not seriously. Han Lu-Chen, oddly, seemed none the worse for the fall. As John and Michael Rourke advanced on four of the free-roaming Mongol horses, Rourke felt the stiffness leaving his left side, his left wrist still tender when he moved it wrong. But almost miraculously, no one had really been hurt. The only casualties, the pilot and navigator, who died in the same instant as the explosion.
That was a Soviet RPG that hit us, Michael. Some of the Second City Chinese.
The horses were still better than a dozen yards away, and to frighten them off now would mean more tracking and running and more time lost before they could reach the friendly German lines. A dying Mongol evidently lashed himself to the saddle of his horse. Bony stumps and raw meat chunks of a human body were tethered at the end of a braided leather rope several feet behind one of the animals.
Maybe Chinese, maybe Mongols. We'll be sitting ducks on horseback. Though faster moving sitting ducks than on foot. We'll have to ride that long defile near the Soviet lines until we can separate from Prokopyev. If I were a Mongol bent on revenge for the destruction of the Second City, I'd be waiting there. And that's what we were passing over when the RPG hit us. It's gonna be you and me. Paul's too weak to do a lot of climbing, and Prokopyev's not in such hot shape either. Maria won't object if I bar you a while, will she?
Do you like Maria?
Rourke took his eyes from the horses for an instant, only that, and glanced toward his son.
You want to talk about her now?
It's not as if we get a lot of downtime together.
Well, she's pretty, she's smart, obviously nuts about you.
You didn't answer my question.
What are you asking me? Is it all right because of what happened to Madison and the baby?
God damn it, you don't mince words, do you, Dad?
I never had the time or the truth to tell the inclination. So no, I don't mince words, Mike.
That's about 3 times in my life you've called me that.
You got nothing better to do than keep count?
Rourke smiled at Michael for a moment, then his eyes were back on the horses.
Yeah, because of Madison and the baby.
Get ready to go for the 2 nearest you. And remember, you're the one who told me these little horses are tough.
You didn't answer my question.
Do I like Maria? Sure, but you treat her like shit. Now!
Rourke lunged toward the animals nearest him, his right fist closing on the bridle of the roan, and his left hand grabbed the reins of the almost brindle-colored one. As the latter animal reared and Rourke sidestepped but held on, he felt as if his left wrist would break, though it didn't.
Got mine!
Rourke only nodded, despite the pain in his wrist, shifting the reins of both animals to his left hand. With his right hand, he drew the grain LS-10 knife and cut the dead rider free. The second time they caught Mongol horses, it was easier. They returned with the animals to the other four members of their party. The group unsaddled the animals, wiped them down, and fed them from the grain bags on each saddle. The saddles themselves, though quite ornate, reminded Rourke of the United States Army's McClellan saddles. They were split along the tree dead up the center. As with the cavalry McClellans from the 19th century, the design served two purposes. In wintertime, the split would conduct heat from the animal's body to the body of the rider. In times of prolonged hard riding, when the animal would lose considerable body mass, the split would prevent galling along the animal's spine. Taking the sturdiest of the horses for themselves, leaving Maria and Paul and Prokopiev to ride down through the defile with the injured Han Lu Chen, John and Michael Rourke started for the higher ground, Soviet assault rifles and Mongol swords lashed to the saddles of their expropriated animals. One of the dead Mongols, whose body was still in the saddle when his animal was captured, carried a 5-centuries-old Glock 17 and several spare magazines. Rourke found the gun totally serviceable after administering a thorough cleaning while the horses rested, then left it with Prokopiev, replacing the corroded ammunition with some of the modern German ammunition manufactured for him to duplicate the 115-grain Federal 9mm BP. Once they reached the German lines, they could find emergency care. Rourke did all that he could for Han Lu Chen without any real facilities at his disposal. They could also get transport to the first Chinese city and its modern hospital. As they rode, they talked about their concern for Annie and about Natalia's problems.
These animals were larger. This would be easier.
Michael Rourke tugged at the Mongol animal as it began to founder in a suddenly deeper drift. The snow still fell.
You talk about me and Maria. What about you and Natalia?
What do you mean exactly?
Rourke walked alongside his horse, holding the reins, pushing against the animal's flanks to propel it ahead.
You're in love with two women. Two women are in love with you. What are you going to do about it?
John Rourke looked at his son.
You have any solutions in mind?
No.
Well, neither do I. I know Natalia's mental collapse is at least partially my fault. Maybe all my fault.
I didn't say that, Dad.
Stating the obvious is a waste of time, and I have never accused you of being a time waster, Michael. I know something has to be done, but if I already knew what, I would have done it centuries ago.
They reached the height of the defile. The snow was less deep here, and they were able to remount the Mongol horses. Rourke looked at his Rolex, computing the amount of time it would take for Paul and the others to reach the danger zone. He spurred his mount ahead. Ahead of them lay a ridgeline that resembled the backbone of some monstrously large prehistoric beast. Between the rocky vertebrae were huddled, at best count from the distance at which Rourke observed, perhaps a dozen and a half men. All those he could see through the German binoculars were Mongols, armed variously with 20th-century automatic rifles and a few captured Soviet arms. Among the weapons, he saw at least one more RPG of the type used to shoot down the Rourke Soviet gunship. The position the Mongols held on the ridgeline dominated the gorge leading to the Russian or German lines. John Rourke lay prone in the snow on a flat promontory of rock overlooking the ridge and the gorge below. In a normal springtime, if there were such things still, the gorge would likely be a torrent. But, as it was, a stream approximately a dozen yards wide at most cut violently down the center of the gorge. White water splashed out of wide, deep-looking pools. In the smaller pools, surface ice formed, starkly white beneath the gray sky. On either side of the gorge, a man could lead a horse, but only a desperate fool or a person with a death wish would have ridden one there, the surface too uneven.
How soon?
Tell you in a second.
Rourke shifted position. Scanning along the length of the gorge with his binoculars, he at last found the party of horsemen. The German binoculars automatically adjusted as Rourke depressed the focus button. In another quarter mile, Paul and the others would be forced to dismount. They would be such easy prey that even the most lackluster marksman, armed with an assault rifle of even marginal quality, could pin them down and kill them. He refocused on the Mongols along the ridgeline. For a moment, his mind was drawn back to his early boyhood when he would hear the thunder of hoofbeats, the crack of pistol shots on the Lone Ranger. He followed the program almost religiously on television. What he saw below him reminded him of the massacre of the Texas Rangers in the original story of The Masked Man. Evil killers lying in wait for slaughter. But John Rourke and his son Michael were in position to stop a bloodbath of innocents, to ambush the ambushers.
We have to hurry, Michael. They'll be into that gorge on foot before we know it.
Rourke cased the binoculars, then, on knees and elbows, worked his way back from the edge. In the spate of super spy films in the middle and late 1960s, there was always a suppressor or silencer handy when the situation required silence. Given the time and some basic otherwise innocuous materials, John Rourke could have built such a device, but there was no time, and such once ordinary items as orange juice cans or power mower mufflers or even potatoes, at least in this icy wilderness, no longer existed. This job required a knife. Stripped of all firearms except for his twin Detonics miniguns, the two Scoremasters, and the Smith & Wesson revolver at his right hip, John Rourke moved as quietly as he could up the back of the ridge. There was evidence of considerable erosion here, and he moved through the chest-deep rill, at times forced to place one foot directly in front of the other because the rill was so sharply V'd. He could not see Michael. Michael moved up from the opposite side of the ridge line, likely not as high yet because there had been greater distance for Michael to travel to his starting point. But the ridge was lower, farther west, so with any luck, Michael should reach the top at approximately the same time as John. Rourke set a precise time for attacking the Mongols, whether both he and his son were in place or not. Much after that, and it might be too late. Clenched tight in John Rourke's fist was the Grain Life Support System 10, and less than 10 feet from him, the nearest of the Mongols lay in wait. From just below the ridge where Rourke hid, he could see that his initial estimate of their numbers seemed close to correct, about 18 of them. Even in the bitter cold of the thin mountain air, when the wind blew in the right direction, the man's smell was like that of an animal fresh from rolling in its own dung. The man held a Soviet assault rifle, beside him a half dozen spare magazines for the weapon, and a single Soviet high-explosive grenade. Rourke glanced at the black face of the Rolex Submariner on his left wrist. It would be time in less than a minute. He reached to the small of his back, unsheathing the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome, the grain knife still in his right hand. He watched the second hand of the Rolex. Time. Rourke launched into a dead run, coming up over the lip of the ridgeline, cutting the distance to the Mongol by half before the man began to turn around. As the man opened his mouth to scream, the tip of the LX-10 entered, punching through the back of the neck. Rourke wrenched the blade free as the body fell. The next nearest Mongol looked around. Rourke lunged. The grain knife impaled the man just below the right breast. Rourke drew the man up and toward him on the knife, raking the smaller Sting 1A across the right side of the Mongol's throat. Rourke turned away as the blood sprayed. He kicked the Mongol off the blade of the grain knife. Rourke let the smaller knife fall from his left hand, shifted the LX-10 from his right, then drew the .44 Magnum 6-inch barrel revolver from the Milt Sparks flap holster at his right hip. Another of the Mongols spun toward him. The .629 Smith rocked in his fist. Rourke was on another Mongol as he drew his pistol to fire. Rourke backhanded the grain knife's primary edge from the left cheekbone and down across the Adam's apple, severing the windpipe. Rourke swung the .629 in the direction of the incoming fire. Rourke could see Michael hacking wildly, half severing the arm of one of the Mongols, then punching the body away as Michael turned toward the next man. Rourke emptied the .629 as he ripped one of the twin stainless Detonics miniguns from the double Alessi shoulder rig. He thumbed the hammer back as he holstered the .629 and fired the Detonics .45. Rourke grabbed the second Detonics. As the first emptied, he cleared the second gun from the leather, jerked the hammer back, and fired. The slide locked back empty. He thrust the Detonics minigun into the waistband of his trousers and tugged free one of the Scoremasters. He fired out the Detonics Combat Master in his right hand, dropping it into the hip pocket of his pants. He drew the second Scoremaster as he fired the first. Against the firepower of the Rourkes, soon no more of the Mongols remained alive to kill. The daylight shining from within the high dome of the flower-shaped First City's administrative petal normally appeared to the naked eye as natural as sunlight. Now, the lights flickered maddeningly, reminding John Rourke of the cheap urban neon signs only he and a few others still alive could remember. No great loss. These flickering lights cast sinister shadows over the pain-etched faces of the wounded sprawled everywhere. They appeared as so many broken and discarded dolls, flung aside by some careless child in a fit of temper. All about them as they walked, Rourke saw death, suffering, and incalculable physical damage. From the most heroically posed shattered statue to a trampled garden of once exquisitely delicate flowers. From blackened, explosion-cratered streets and walkways where normal lives and commerce had been conducted seconds before the carnage, to the glitter and crunch beneath their booted feet of the shattered glass from now windowless buildings. Chinese troops in irregular numbers, attired in ragged, smoke-smudged uniforms, ran to reinforce defensive positions against renewed attack. Others aided men and women in dirty and blood-stained hospital attire as they tended the civilians and military personnel who had some slight chance to be saved. Rourke's son Michael and Maria Leuden, the German archaeologist, left Rourke and Rubinstein as they entered the city. Rourke personally placed the Chinese intelligence agent Han Lu Chen on a commandeered monorail car so he could be speeded to the medical center. Han's injuries were grave, sustained at the hands of the barbarians in the second city. The wounds required the sort of immediate medical attention that under the circumstances they could only get through force. John Thomas Rourke dropped to one knee beside an old woman who lay beside an overturned flower cart. Her inner thigh bled heavily, but the bleeding was not arterial. Rourke applied pressure with his fingertips, and the flow of blood eased as a Chinese soldier dug through a medical field kit. The private soldier at last found what he sought and began to apply a pressure bandage. Rourke nodded to Paul Rubinstein, who bent over beside him, dropped to his knees, and helped the soldier with the proper application of the dressing. Paul had seen Rourke do it often enough. Paul Rubinstein had good hands. He obeyed well and had a mind quick to learn. The bandage in place, the old woman's eyelids flickered, shy, dark eyes probing his and Rubinstein's face, and her frail hands clutched at theirs, inadvertently smearing her hands with her own blood. Rourke smiled down at her, stood, wiped his hands clean of the blood, then picked up his parka and began walking again, Paul beside him. Paul's right arm was crudely slung in a shirt sleeve, much of the not-too-badly-burned area exposed. None of the Chinese stopped to marvel at the wound because so many of the Chinese were themselves wounded. The two friends kept walking. At last, John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein reached the steps of the government building. An immaculately dressed woman in modestly high heels and modestly slit chongsan waited at the base of the steps. The look of fear in her eyes cast a veil of frenzy over the otherwise serenely beautiful face. Rourke recognized her, a personal aide to the Chinese chairman. The epicanthic lids closed and opened, the movement like the fluttering of a bird's wing.
The helicopter that carried your daughter, Dr. Rourke, and Major Tiamarovna, and Captain Hammerschmidt, we lost contact with it. We presume it down somewhere over the Yellow Sea.
John Thomas Rourke began running as she uttered the last word, lost, tossed aside his parka and other temporarily unnecessary gear as she said the simple word, down. As he reached the steps, running into the government building, he took them three at a time in a dead run. Paul Rubinstein was beside him. Rourke glanced at his friend as the woman's voice behind them droned on.
A Soviet helicopter reportedly was encountered, and there was an exchange of fire, and...
I know!
Rourke responded not to the condolences of the female interpreter, but to the unspoken words of Paul Rubinstein beside him. Annie, Rourke's daughter, and Paul's wife. Rourke reached the height of the steps, running faster. Paul nearly stayed abreast of him. Rourke merely eyed the first city guards who momentarily interposed themselves in the open doorway, not needing to shove past them because they moved aside before him, unbidden. Rourke saw his wife Sarah standing at the head of the staircase, legs spread apart, face smudged. The staircase widened gradually, leading upward from the far end of the great hall through which Rourke and Rubinstein ran, upward toward the executive offices. A pistol was belted to Sarah's pregnant midsection, a black t-shirt visible beneath an open German camouflage BDU blouse.
There's been no word, John. No word at all.
Are you sure they went down over the water? Weren't blown up when the missiles or whatever struck?
He was running the staircase like a hill, charging up its midsection, taking Sarah into his arms as he reached the top.
I'm afraid, John.
John Rourke held his wife tight in his arms. He forced himself to walk rather than run because she was beside him. It was one of the most difficult things he had ever done. Paul Rubinstein, their son-in-law, walked with them.
But Comrade Colonel, ground forces.
With more ground forces, he could have conquered. Nikolai Antonovich walked quickly over the freeze-hardened, snow-packed ground, extemporizing orders to the aide nearly running beside him.
Withdraw all functional personnel and equipment from the area surrounding the second Chinese city. Leave only what is necessary to cover withdrawal of the wounded. Whatever the nature of the explosion there, it has likely neutralized the preponderance of their forces. I want to be able to attack the first city in full strength within 12 hours from now. They must still reel from the blow they have already sustained. Order the commander of our army in Liedvelded Island to consolidate his forces within the Hecla volcanic cone itself and to abandon, then destroy the German base outside Hecla. I want a full airborne assault force ready to move at a moment's notice against Eden Base in American Georgia. I want that force ready within 12 hours. A coordinated attack will further sap German military strength. I fly to the underground city for troops.
Antonovich quickened his pace to a run as his gunship's rotor blades turned and snow swirled in their downdraft. There was one other possibility if he could carry it off without losing everything. If he could make contact. Louise Walensky was smiling like an idiot, almost laughing as she bumped into him.
Oh, excuse me, sir.
Jason Darkwood was halfway over the flange for the watertight door leading to the Reagan's Bridge when he noticed her eyes.
Is something wrong, Lieutenant? Do I have my shoes on backward or something?
She ran the free hand that didn't hold her clipboard back through her pretty hair. He wasn't wearing shoes at all, of course, but rather issue combat boots, as he always wore, with his Class B uniform.
Lieutenant?
Oh, nothing, sir. I was just really pleased that we got caught onto that transponder signal in time to get them all out of the water. I think Lieutenant Mott did a great job with tracking, and Lieutenant Bowman, too, of course. Where would communications have been without navigation, after all?
Words to ponder indeed, Lieutenant.
Darkwood continued on his way, through the companionway, through the next watertight doorway, and to the con. Communications Officer Mott saw him coming.
Captain's on the bridge!
The Reagan's bridge crew started to attention, or what was left of them anyway.
Carry on.
Darkwood proceeded to his command chair as the bridge personnel looked back to their stations. Not only was his warfare officer, Lieutenant Walensky, missing, but so were Lieutenants Junior Grade Kelly and Bowman. Darkwood sat down, ran his fingers over the console arms, and looked at Sebastian, his tall, leanly muscled first officer, leaning over the illuminated plotting board.
Mr. Sebastian?
Aye, sir.
Where are the absent members of the bridge crew? I literally bumped into Lieutenant Walensky back there.
He gestured behind him.
You pose an interesting question, Captain.
Interesting question. Do you have an interesting answer?
No, sir. Not at all. The answer isn't that terribly interesting at all.
Darkwood stood up, took three steps down, and stood leaning against the first officer's chair.
Even if it isn't, Mr. Sebastian, share it with me.
Lieutenant Commander T.J. Sebastian's eyes shifted quickly aft, along the bridge, and then to Darkwood's face. Sebastian's brown hands distending over the illuminated surface of the chart table as if it were a tactile-sensitive video game.
Actually, Jason, surprise!
Congratulations, Jason. Captain Jason Darkwood, Captain of the USS Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Margaret Barrow, Chief Medical Officer of the USS Reagan, held a radio fax transcription in her left hand. Radio fax messages were only possible when the ship was surfaced. Behind him, he heard the click of the microphone Sebastian used when relaying orders from the bridge.
Attention, all hands. Now hear this. This is First Officer Sebastian speaking.
Captain, Darkwood thought. He was captain of the Reagan well enough, but his rank was commander. He motioned to interrupt, but Sebastian turned to his task of informing the ship's crew.
I have the honor to announce the promotion of Commander Jason Darkwood to the rank of captain, with all honors and privileges pertaining thereto. All personnel performing non-essential ship's functions, ten hut.
Margaret Barrow handed Jason the radio fax. Department of the Navy orders signed by Admiral Ron and countersigned by President Fellows. The President's signature wasn't necessary to make the orders of promotion official, but it was quite an honor. More of an honor, though, was the collection of signatures on the reverse of the radio fax. Every officer and man of the Reagan. Sebastian held the microphone in his left hand, rose to his full height, which was substantial, and saluted.
Captain Darkwood, the microphone, sir.
He offered the microphone. Darkwood took it and stared at it a moment.
Go ahead, Jason.
Darkwood didn't know what to say.
This is the captain speaking, I suppose. Well, I really am a captain, not just a captain. Oh, nuts. A man couldn't ask for a better crew. I've just been handed the radio fax all of you signed. I know I'll receive the official document once we return to Midway, but this is the copy I'll always treasure. Lest I have to remind anyone, we have a submarine to run, and our Soviet friends would be more than happy to take it off our hands if we let them. But for this moment, thank you. Thank you all so very much. Thank you. Now, return to your stations.
Darkwood handed the microphone back to Sebastian.
The captain is receiving his cake.
Darkwood looked at Sebastian, then looked toward Margaret Barrow. Behind the ship's doctor stood his warfare, sonar, and navigation officers. Warfare holding an impossibly large sheet cake with chocolate frosting on top, and sonar and navigation holding plates, napkins, and a funny-looking knife Darkwood assumed was designed for cutting cakes.
Slices will be available during the regular mess schedule. That is all.
Warfare Officer Walensky looked up from the cake.
It's hot, sir.
I'll take that into consideration, Lieutenant.
Darkwood nodded, smiling, feeling embarrassed and slightly tongue-tied. Sam Aldridge and Tom Stanhope appeared on the bridge behind his bridge personnel. Aldridge grinned. Margaret Barrow leaned up and kissed him on the cheek.
I've got that Russian woman to look after, Jason. All the best.
She turned and ran off, past Walensky and the cake that had been decorated too hurriedly. Frosting was gooing in the middle where the temperature was still too warm, and all the bridge crew nodded around her.
Captain, may I suggest that Lieutenant Walensky continue her supervision of the cake and undertake its equitable distribution to all members of the bridge crew and the remainder of the ship's company after you have made the initial cut?
Jason Darkwood wasn't quite certain what Sebastian had said, but he agreed with it anyway, and Lieutenant Junior Grade Bowman smiled at him as she handed him the odd-looking knife. A piece of cake on a saucer in his left hand, Jason Darkwood pushed through the door into Margaret Barrow's sick bay, past Lieutenant Stanhope's Marine Guard.
As you were, Corporal.
The young Annie Rourke Rubenstein, who'd been the only one conscious when the Reagan surfaced in answer to the transponder, now lay asleep, sedated, he guessed, on one of the beds at the opposite end of sick bay from the Russian woman. Darkwood had never seen Annie before, but he had seen the Russian woman. Annie Rubenstein was beautiful. The Russian woman, Major Natalia Temerovna, tossed and turned beneath the blanket. Restraints crisscrossed the bed. She looked beautiful as well, and tragic. In the third occupied bed lay a man, resting comfortably, it appeared. Obviously military, he looked like a blonde and blue-eyed version of black-skinned, brown-eyed Sam Aldridge. Margaret Barrow came out of her office.
Brought me my cake?
Brought you your cake. It's very good. Taking the welfare of the crew is my utmost concern, as I always do. I realized it'd be necessary to have two pieces myself, just to make certain it was entirely suitable. Then I carefully checked with Sam Aldridge, who, as it turned out, is quite the connoisseur of cake. He liked it too.
Well, if the Marine Corps approves, gee whiz.
So how are your patients?
She tasted the cake.
It is good. Well, let's see. Machinist First Class Hong, he had the blood blister, remember? And there's...
Right. Hong's a fine man. I was more concerned about women.
You never change.
She smiled too sweetly.
Let's see. Well, Mrs. Rubenstein voluntarily accepted a sedative once I told her Major Chemerovna was stable, and that she'd be of greater value to the Major if she were well rested once the Major awakened.
Well, how about Major Chemerovna?
That's another story altogether, Jason. I'm no psychiatrist, but from what Mrs. Rubenstein told me, Major Chemerovna's a pretty sick woman.
Give me a best guess.
She shrugged her shoulders and eyebrows in unison. It looked kind of sexy, Darkwood thought absently. But to him, Margaret Barrow always looked kind of sexy.
It probably just started as what you or I would call a psychosis.
Oh, I use that word all the time. Tell me in easy-to-understand words, Maggie.
She shrugged, just her shoulders this time, as she perched on the edge of a surgery table.
From what Mrs. Rubenstein said, and from my own limited observations, the Major seems to be suffering from, among other things, manic depression, but is locked in a severe depressive state. And like I said, I'm no shrink. She's a very sick woman, Jason. She suffers currently from total disorientation. Obviously, she's experiencing hallucinations, but she's catatonic most of the time. There's nothing I can do for her except monitor her vital functions, keep her cleaned, bathed, and sedated until we reach port. In layman's language, she's gone off the deep end, Jason. And after what she's evidently been through, some sort of battle, as Mrs. Rubenstein put it.
Some sort of battle. And the man?
He's captain of commandos, Otto Hammerschmidt, of the Republic of New Germany in Argentina. That's what he said before I sedated him. And he's got very fast hands. He's gonna be all right, though.
One of the reconstructed Nazis, huh?
That's not nice to say, Jason.
Fine.
His ship's company now included a German officer, the daughter of the twice legendary hero Dr. John Thomas Rourke, and a major in the Soviet KGB, who was gorgeous, even if she was loony at the moment. Both women 5 centuries old and holding. And the Reagan was farther away from Midwake than he wanted to consider.
You, wouldn't like to come to my cabin and celebrate my promotion, would you?
She leaned back and rocked on one heel.
How?
Oh, I meant maybe just a cup of coffee and some conversation.
You want to be treated for mental illness, too?
Can't blame a guy for trying, Maggie.
I'd blame me if you succeeded. Yeah, I'll come, if it's more than coffee.
Are you suggesting we might examine and possibly test the medicinal liquor stores to confirm that no chemical breakdown has taken place that might possibly alter its effectiveness?
And who did you get that line from?
I've been studying circumlocution with Sebastian.
She came into his arms. Darkwood's eyes drifted toward Major Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna. He'd learned firsthand that she was one hell of a woman. He looked away and thought of a transponder signal relayed to him from Midwake. The signal originated from the emergency transponder Dr. Rourke received when he left Midwake. Satellite buoys picked up the signal. Jason received a terse message from Midwake Command to respond. A search followed that took less than an hour, but seemed like more, to pinpoint the source of the transponder. A helicopter lay on the bottom, shot all to hell, it appeared. On the surface of the Yellow Sea, they found 2 women and a man, only one of them conscious. Annie Rourke Rubenstein, keeping the others afloat. She had her father's guts, certainly. Clinging to them just as dearly as the human beings were the weapons, more antiques, not dissimilar from what Dr. Rourke carried, his Detonics 45s. Why was the helicopter shot down? Had the war on the surface of the Earth that Dr. Rourke told them about and which they experienced firsthand for a brief time heated up? The Rourke woman, Mrs. Rubenstein, seemed past exhaustion, but hadn't seemed anywhere near to giving up. Surface dwellers were strange, certainly, but in many ways they were little different from the people of Midwake. They were driven to survival, and driven by it.
What are you thinking, Jason?
Margaret Barrow pushed a little away from him.
It isn't about me, is it?
No, but it isn't about anyone else. Are you going to eat the rest of that cake? I mean, it would be a sin to let it go to waste after all the effort everyone put into making it.
She turned around, took the plate off her desk, and handed it to him.
Yes. You never change.
Colonel Wolfgang Mann, de facto supreme commander of German forces in the field, stood, the tips of his splayed fingers touching the tabletop, its black mirror finish reflecting a distorted image of him as he spoke.
The Soviet offensive is continuing. I have just received a communique that Soviet forces have consolidated their position in Liedfeldied Island, within the Hekla community itself, and have destroyed our base outside Hekla. Soviet troops are apparently massing for another attack on Eden Base. Meanwhile, a small but very mobile force continues to harass efforts in New Germany to resupply forces in the field. And, because of the presence of this force, substantial reinforcement of our troops in the field is out of the question, even though we have sustained significant casualties. In the same report from our installation outside Eden Base, to which I alluded a moment ago, I was informed that the Japanese Lieutenant Kurinami was reported shot down in battle against the Soviets during a raid on their staging area. Kurinami is missing and presumed dead. As concerns the whereabouts of Frau Rubinstein, Fräulein Major Tyamarovna, and Captain Hammerschmidt, I have 15 helicopters and 3 J-7Vs in the air over the Yellow Sea, searching for the downed gunship or even some sign of wreckage. So far, there is no sign.
The chairman of the first Chinese city rose from his black lacquer chair, several dark bruises visible on his face, his normally patent leather-looking hair slightly mussed, his eyes weary.
So many things, Dr. Rourke. have been done by you and your family for our people. I am ashamed I can do no more than offer you what meager resources still remain at my disposal.
He had said nothing and everything. John Rourke tented his fingers to keep his hands from trembling. Michael Rourke and Maria Leuden entered the conference room unannounced. John looked at his son and the German archaeologist. Michael took a seat at the far end of the table. Maria stood beside his chair. Her devotion to Michael bordered on slavishness, but Rourke pushed the thought of that away. His son's relationship with the woman, pleasant, intelligent, was none of his business. Paul Rubinstein, his injuries properly attended to, his face grim as Sarah Rourke spoke.
I think I can speak for my daughter Anne, even though her husband is present.
She looked at Paul Rubinstein, touched her hand to his.
I think Annie and Captain Hammerschmidt are alive out there. Even considering what my husband told you about Natalia's present state of mental collapse, I think she's still alive. Even so, I realize that the war effort is for the greater good. And I realize you can't keep combing the same stretch of ocean for them. They wouldn't want you to. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I don't want to say it, but I think they'd want me to say it anyway.
I may have a potential solution to all of our problems. I gave Annie something when she boarded the helicopter. It was a special transponder given to me by the naval authorities in Midwake. It's the same device issued to the Marine Commandos and Naval Frogmen as part of their survival kits. It has a destruct device built into it which can be activated in the event of capture, of course. But when used as intended, it's designed to broadcast a special low-frequency homing beacon that can be picked up by communications buoys the people of Midwake use in much the same manner we use communication satellites before the night of the war. The frequency is computer monitored 24 hours a day. If Annie had the time to activate the frequency, there's a substantial possibility that the reason no sign of survivors from the crash of the gunship has been found on the surface is that there are no survivors on the surface.
Do you imply, Doctor?
Yes, they may be aboard a U.S. submarine operating out of Midwake. I have no means of contacting Midwake, at least not directly. But if I can have a German gunship, Colonel Mann, and enough fuel, I can reach the approximate area of open water beneath which Midwake is located. If you can loan me a very powerful conventional explosive...
Rourke used the word conventional intentionally because he knew the Germans were working on a nuclear device in the event the Russians gained access to such weapons and used them.
A powerful conventional explosive detonated on the surface above Midwake would be bound to be picked up on their sensors. They'll come to investigate and I'll make contact. If they've picked up Annie and Natalia and Captain Hammerschmidt, I'll know at once. And if they haven't, and perhaps with their help, I don't know. We'll keep looking, no matter how long we have to. And their submarines can help. But either way...
Rourke studied his hands for a moment.
I may be able to effect some sort of alliance with the government of Midwake. With the aid of their underwater technology, we can introduce a wild card.
A wild card, Doctor?
Something unexpected, Colonel. We could introduce a wild card into the war against the Soviets, and if we use it effectively, knock them out. It's only a matter of time before Colonel Antonovich or the Soviet leadership of the underground city, perhaps by now with Karamazov's death they're working together, but it's only a matter of time until someone from the Soviet faction on the surface successfully makes a second contact with the Soviet underwater complex and works out an alliance. The Soviet forces have considerable nuclear capabilities, as we've discussed before. If Antonovich were able to introduce such capabilities as a wild card of his own, we'd lose.
I can provide such a helicopter, Herr Doctor.
It'll need amphibious capabilities, and as much as I'd like to strip it of weapons so we'd be able to fly faster and farther between refuelings, we'll be over Soviet water much of the time. There's no telling what we'll encounter. So conversely, I'll need all the weapons we can pack aboard.
John looked at Paul Rubinstein.
Come with?
You couldn't stop me, John. Not even you.
Dad!
Rourke looked to his son.
No. You'll be needed to help Colonel Mann and your mother.
Sarah started to speak, and he knew what she'd say.
If I were Colonel Mann, I'd keep a minimal presence in Iceland outside Hekla, just to keep the Russians bottled up, then hit the staging area near Eden Base in Georgia. If the Russians can be forced out, the German installation outside Eden Base can become a staging area along the German supply route.
My plan exactly, Doctor.
And you and the baby will be safer with Colonel Mann's forces, either here or in New Germany. I'm not about to lose everyone I care for.
even though there's a substantial possibility for success of the mission. In the event of failure, failure will be fatal.
No! Damn it, John!
Yes, Sarah. You're not coming with Paul and me. It's too dangerous. No purpose would be served by endangering you more than you already have been. It's dangerous enough just staying here or going to New Germany. I know you want to come, and I know why. For the same reason I'm going. But you're not.
John Rourke stood up.
John!
He didn't look at his wife.
No.
At times, the oppressive gray clouds, already partially obscured by the heavy snowfall, were almost totally blocked by squadrons of black-skinned Soviet gunships. The drifts lay deeper in the ravine Akira Kuranami followed, slowing his movements. Though we might make better progress on the higher ground, there was the very real danger of being spotted from the air by the massing Russian helicopters. And time was of the essence. The growing Soviet armada would soon attack Eden Base. The distance to Eden Base was more miles than Kuranami wanted to contemplate, but John Rourke's retreat was much closer. At the retreat, he could use the Rourke's powerful radio to contact the German installation outside Eden Base and pass along intelligence on Soviet strength. If the Soviets attacked without the forces of New Germany knowing the heightened numbers in their fleet, the Russians would achieve total military victory. Eden Base would be overrun here in what, before the night of the war, had been the United States. The space shuttles would be destroyed, their computer records seized, or worse still, erased. The frozen embryonic life forms of animals and birds, the botanical cuttings and seeds, much of the future of life on Earth would vanish. The Chinese, as Kuranami understood it, and the Germans, of course, used their underground shelters as environmental arks, as well as circumstances allowed. The Icelandics, spared by a freak effect of the Van Allen radiation belts, survived in their network of geothermal-powered pockets of civilization in the Arctic wasteland that now blanketed the Earth to well below 60 degrees north latitude. The Eden Project stores carried species destroyed by the night of the war and the following great conflagration, species not found in any of the surviving enclaves or anywhere else on Earth. The Eden computers carried the accumulated knowledge of the centuries, much of it irreplaceable. Eden Base had to be saved at all costs, and John Rourke's retreat was the only hope. Freezing cold, hungry, exhausted, Akira Kuranami continued to put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. In his mind's eye, he put the face of Elaine Halvorsen ahead of him, going on ever toward her. It was becoming increasingly difficult to leave New Germany, Dodd knew, and these disciples of the dead leader might well be the last he could count on for help until the Soviet offensive was crushed. In a shack within the construction zone, a chemical heater provided warmth enough that the occupants could lower the hoods of their parkas. Christopher Dodd stood as part of a ragged semicircle around the heat source. Damien Rausch, the apparent leader of the Germans, stood across the heater from Dodd. Rausch was tall, broad-shouldered, and the muscled neck bespoke strength and fitness. His voice, as he spoke, was a sonorous baritone. The English bore no trace of accent as far as Christopher Dodd could detect.
You seem to misunderstand the circumstances, Commander. We were not sent here to this inhospitable wasteland to obey your orders. I have my orders, and with the help of my men shall carry them out.
I was given to understand.
Herr Commander, the ultimate goal of the Nazi movement is not to benefit a self-serving astronaut who wishes to be king over some 100 people on an otherwise unpopulated continent.
I have plans, sir.
And so do we, Commander Dodd, so do we. At the moment you are part of our plans, the knowledge within your computer banks, certain stored strategic items, these very craft themselves, all have their potential use to the Reich. The very existence of this base further saps the manpower of the rebellious forces under the command of Wolfgang Mann, an asset to our sacred movement in and of itself. You are obsessed with Akira Kuranami. That you fear so greatly one obvious racial inferior speaks poorly for your manhood, Commander. No, he shall die, but not at the expense of the greater purpose.
It sounded to Dodd as if part of Rausch's sentence was unfinished or missing, and he hesitated to speak lest he inadvertently interrupt. But Rausch remained silent.
Greater purpose? You mean a revolution?
I mean evolution, Commander. The survival of the fittest. Your Japanese nemesis will die if you are correct that he will go to ground at the retreat of the bothersome Dr. Rourke. But only because this fellow's death serves the greater purpose. See that you serve the greater purpose, Commander. See to that if you value your life.
Christopher Dodd shivered. Roush reminded him of the devil. Annie Rourke opened her eyes. There was a gray half-light all about her, a hum so subtle she could not detect it at all unless she concentrated on it, and one thing else, the smell of disinfectant. She closed her eyes. The gunship. The ocean. Otto injured. Natalia unable to function. From the pocket of the uncomfortable trousers she wore, she took the signaling device her father gave her. He called it a transponder. For centuries, or so it seemed, she fought to stay afloat, to keep herself and Natalia and Otto afloat. And when it was finally ending, they came. The man with the dark wavy hair, the wolfish smile, and the pretty dark eyes. Into this. This.
Oh. Oh.
She sat bolt upright, a restraint buckled loosely over her waist.
Hi. Mrs. Rubenstein. You feeling better?
She turned toward the reassuringly feminine voice. A light clicked on, a small lamp. It lit part of the bed in which Annie lay. The light also shone on the face of the woman by her bed, her hair more brown than Annie's, what some called dark auburn. Like Annie's mother, Sarah, the woman had pretty gray-green eyes. They sparkled over a full, smiling mouth. She wore a white lab coat, and beneath it a khaki uniform shirt and matching khaki skirt.
I'm Margaret Barrow, remember?
Oh, Dr. Barrow. I remember. How...
Why don't I save you the questions and the energy, and I'll just give you the standard answers, okay?
Okay.
Fine. You're aboard the USS Ronald Wilson Reagan, the finest attack submarine in the Midwake fleet. You've been asleep for about 10 hours. Frankly, I thought you'd sleep longer than that. The man who was in charge of the team that pulled you out of the water is captain of this ship. He's Captain Jason Darkwood. Just promoted while you were asleep, as a matter of fact, from commander. Major Chemerovna's condition is unchanged. Physically, I can say that she's resting comfortably. Mentally, well, that's another question. Captain, Hammerschmidt, right?
Right.
Well, his injuries weren't so severe as you might have feared. He won't be swimming any marathons for a little while. He should be up and around soon enough. He's built tough. A hattie like that for technical medical jargon, huh? I know. Your father's a doctor. I was the one who worked on him first when they brought him in.
I remember. I remember Daddy telling me if it hadn't been for you, he wouldn't have lived.
Margaret Barrow shrugged her shoulders and smiled.
Oh, patients always say that kind of thing about doctors. All I did was keep him breathing until the real pros at Midway could take over. Your dad had the best. He's a good guy. How's he doing?
I hope he's alive. He and my husband, they were trying...
She felt a little lightheaded.
Hey, Mrs. Rubenstein.
Dr. Barrow put a hand gently against Annie's chest.
You're gonna wear yourself out, and it's no good for anybody. Look, why don't you sleep a little more? Annie?
What? Oh. All right.
I'm Maggie.
Margaret Barrow smiled and stuck out her right hand. Annie grasped it, and they shook hands. It wasn't any kind of silly, feminine handshake, but strong, like shaking hands with a man.
Maggie, we've got to get in touch with my father and my husband, and the German authorities, and...
Look, Annie, I just fix people. Communications isn't my department. Rest here a little while longer, and I will make sure Captain Darkwood gets down here to sickbay, and you can tell him. Everything's his department, okay? Annie...
Despite herself, Annie Rourke Rubenstein smiled, pushed her hair away from her face and neck, and leaned her head back on the pillow. She closed her eyes, but just to humor Maggie Barrow.